started.
I'm Chris Sharon, and I teach at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I haven't been teaching this week. It's a one-time session on the board of directors, which is a great joy. And so that's been the main thing I've been doing this week. And the board meeting's mostly finished. We have this great community meeting opportunity with the Forest Service tonight, so I hope everyone's planning on participating in that. But I'm doing this one session, raising some questions about the relationship between faith and secularism. And so that's what this session is about, faith in the secular age. And I wanted to start just by a couple of anecdotal pieces that provoke me to think about these questions. And there's lots of evidence that you come with from your lives, and we'll have time at various points to stop and talk about that. But just off the shelf in our chalet, this is the Atlantic, most recent Atlantic issue. Anybody seen that? The End of Men. It's a great article, but it's their ideas. It's their ideas issue, and they have 14 and a half of the most powerful ideas of the year. One of them is the Catholic Church is finished. That's idea number 9. So we live in a time when a major intellectual magazine declares the end of the Catholic Church. And it's really related to the constant unfolding, unbelievable really, that there could be more unfolding of terrible stories about child sexual abuse. So that on the one hand, the end of the Catholic Church. Then the most recent issue of Rolling Stone, the sort of lead pop culture, pop music magazine with Lady Gaga on the cover. And I did a whole session on Lady Gaga last week, so if you weren't here, I'm sorry you missed it. But she's interviewed, the Rolling Stone magazine has this history of doing Rolling Stone interviews with people who are top entertainers. And according to the social media criterion, she's the most famous celebrity in the world right now. She has more Facebook friends than Barack Obama. 10 million. She's a singer. She's a pop singer. And she, at the end of the interview, the interviewer says, "It seems like you've become more religious or spiritual in the last year or so." And she says, "It's hard not to believe that God hasn't been watching out for me when I've had such obstacles with drugs and rejection and people not believing me. It's been a long and continuous road, but it's hard to just chalk it all up to myself. I have to believe there's something greater than myself." So on the one hand, the end of the Catholic Church. On the other hand, Lady Gaga, who isn't the typical preacher, saying, "I give God the credit." And then the third piece of evidence is this little book by Tariq Ramadan. And he's known particularly among scholars as a very interesting voice among Western Muslims. And on the back of the book it says, "Tariq Ramadan is a Muslim Martin Luther." So the religious reformer who maybe matters most today is not Christian. He's Muslim. So you put those three together and you have what I would describe as a pretty crazy religious environment. There's lots of different things going on, and the complexity could be just added on to. I start with a picture of empty pews because the question I want to primarily talk about is a transition from a time, at least in the trajectory of Western culture, through Europe into the experience many of us have had in North America, of a transition from a time when it really wasn't conceivable to not believe in God. There was certainly a huge range of faithfulness, but the conception of not believing in God just wasn't common. The ordinary person didn't imagine, in a sense, not believing God is a okay way of life. So what I want to try and get at is what's changed, what's happened that's led us to a society where that's quite common. This picture from Van Gogh, I think, is a wonderful transition object. How many of you have been to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam? A few of you. I was just there earlier this summer, and I didn't know this painting, actually, but in the context of his life, it plays a very interesting role. As many of you know, his dad was a very pious pastor, and he grew up in a parsonage, and he even was a lay evangelist as a teenager, very fervent, and then as he grew, began to have significant doubts about that, and in one way, you can think of some of his paintings as a commentary on his growing disaffection with the faith of his childhood and the strictness and the piety and his whole sense of what was happening to the church as an institution and its growing irrelevance. And so you have this, what he called the peasant's churchyard, and there are some very simple wooden crosses around the ground and then this crumbling old tower from a church and then circling above it black birds. And in a way functioned for him as a metaphor for what he thought was happening to institutional religion. He, in a sense, he's known as a painter of light. And in a way, he thought of his own painting and his use of light as a kind of secularized preaching, that the light itself was a way to speak of the holy in a way completely different from his experience with the faith of his childhood. We get to a time now where it's not uncommon to see more militant atheism, God just being scratched out. This is graffiti from a pub in Dublin, or in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and there was a alternative church community meeting in this pub. They met when the pub was open. They thought that was more hospitable to not go when the pub was closed. And so this graffiti was in response to the fact that they were meeting in this pub. And so they just came out and created a liturgy around the graffiti. And what it brings to mind is the fact that we're in a time now where in Western Europe and North America, belief in God is just one option. Many other options exist. So just to demonstrate that among ourselves, we'll just take a quick poll and ask how many know personally somebody who's of a different faith than Christianity. Maybe someone is of a different faith than Christianity. Anybody not Christian of another faith tradition? No. How about how many of you know someone who doesn't go to church? How about know personally someone who you know for a fact doesn't believe in God? Most of you. Not all of you, though. How many of you know someone that doesn't believe in God and you respect them? You think they're good people? Many of you. So what I want to try and get at is what in our particular trajectory of history through the contemporary, through the West, through Europe and into North America, what happened in that that moved us from a time when people didn't really think about what it might be to live not believing in God to a time when it's just about as common as could be. And I'm drawing on a philosopher named Charles Taylor. He taught for many years at McGill in Canada and at Northwestern in Illinois, and he's written a book called The Secular Age. It's a big, fat doorstop book, and it's one of the reasons why I teach it, because most people aren't going to read it, but it's really a great book, and I highly recommend it if you have patience. But what he's trying to do is do a different story about secularization. What are some ways you would think of secularization, just off the top of your heads? What would be a sort of definition or working way of thinking of secularization?
Christmas. Changing Christmas for the original meaning, let's say, to Jesus' birth, to this holiday.
Great. Yeah, so that would be an example of the cultural meaning shifting from a religious meaning, a meaning connected to the Christian faith, to a more diffuse cultural meaning. So that's That's one level in which we see this happening for sure, the cultural level, yeah.
You could say the same thing about Sunday.
Yeah.
That it was a day of worship and certainly a day of rest, and now it's just a day like any other day. Lots of people work and stores are open.
Yeah. And some of that has been institutionalized in law, and so that lasts longer than some of the cultural habits. So one of the levels of secularization is cultural adherence. Do we go to church? Do we consider Christmas a religious holiday and so forth? But then there's this structural political level. Do we have, for instance, in whatever your particular state is, a law that no alcohol can be purchased on Sunday? That's an example, I think, of a religious-inspired law that can have a pretty long shadow. Or the fact that we have a chaplain in Congress. I mean, that's sort of an odd thing, that everyone, when they enter the Congress, and when the president inaugurated, they use the Bible. I mean, that those kinds of things are legacies of a time when Christianity, particularly, but you could say just religion in general, had a powerful public structural impact. That's lessening. But Charles Taylor wanted to get at a third level, not the cultural, not the political, but what he calls a background assumption level. And one way to think about this, here's a little exercise we can do that gets us thinking about this. What would you say, just looking at this, that this guy is up to?
Taking
what would he take photos like that for, you think?
He's a geologist.
Fossils.
Could be a geologist looking for fossils, research. So what background assumptions do you have that give you the possibility of interpreting what he's doing in that way?
I lost a contact once.
The set of background assumptions that you have to say fossil or to say research or to say geologist all imply a scientific understanding of a scientific method and scientific worldview, and a sense that there may be ancient fossils in this rock, or that someone might study rocks instead of worship them. In another time and place, you might look at this picture and think this is an ancient site of worship and he's prostrate. And this is some kind of a metal object that's part of worship. Many other things might be possible. That idea that there are certain kinds of assumptions, background understandings, which we don't usually think about consciously, but which we use all the time in making interpretive judgments about the world around us, is the level that Charles Taylor was trying to get at. What changes happened in the development of society that allowed for us, instead of assuming everyone of course believes in God, to assume that of course there are multiple paths, some of which include not believing in God at all? So that's an interesting question, and most people writing about secularization have not asked that question. And Charles Taylor, if you were in Heidi's session this morning, she was talking about phenomenology, and he works out of that tradition, and it's a tradition that asks questions about embodied knowing. She said this morning that in French there are two kinds of knowing, savoir, which is a kind of objective knowing the fact, a conscious, rational knowing of the fact, and connaître, which is a kind of embodied knowing. So take the example of a map. You're hiking up the valley. You've never been up the valley before. Well, obviously there's a trail, but it's feeling really long to you. And it's a hot afternoon. You're thinking, Heart Lake has got to be here somewhere. You know. And so you can get out your map and look at the map and how the valley's laid out and say, oh, well, we're here. But I've been up that trail, I don't know, a lot of times. And I sort of know where I am by the microclimate that I'm in. Am I in the fern section, or am I in the dry shrub section with the avalanche chute coming down? Or am I in that sort of magical lodgepole pine section that just you walk down into. And so I don't even really think about the map. I just know where I am. And he's trying to get at this question of how does the society as a whole change so that people know where they are and in a sense assume that it's okay for people to have these widely divergent spiritual trajectories. So that's the question. And where I want to go with it is to say, how does that matter for congregations? For congregations that are actually interested in not having all empty pews. And too many of our churches have in the mainline Protestant world have seen mainly decline, emptier and emptier pews. The ELCA, certainly. Every single year of its existence, it's lost membership. So a couple of hooks. We can't obviously tell the whole story, but I want to just find a couple of hooks that will help us think about what it is that led to this change in our background assumptions. If I take my watch off and put it here, I won't look at it and I'll lose track of time. But if I leave it on my wrist, I won't look at it and I'll lose track of time. So I'm glad there's a clock right there. And you can keep me honest, too. So here's one important change. This is Sir Isaac Newton and the famous apple falling. I'm quite sure it didn't happen that way, that he looked at an apple and said, aha, the law of gravity. But the bigger picture of what transpired during these early years in a sense of the rise of science is what Charles Taylor calls the disenchantment of the universe. What does he mean by that? Well, if you think about, in a sense, what philosophers and theologians of science call the God of the gaps, God really was a way of talking about why things happened. And there was great agency attributed to God. So God was very much present and interacting in a daily way. And there was a sense of great power in spirits and in a sense the power of evil and the power of good were a very present experience, and so there was a sense certainly of a universe being inhabited by more than you could see. And so when you begin to explain certain things by scientific method, and it becomes this explained fact, this proven fact. Take Galileo, for instance. Take Copernicus. Any of these great early scientists who had quite a hard road to hoe in order to get their proposal heard, partly because it threw into chaos some of the deeply held faith beliefs that had been held for many, many years. So you have this image of God being the cause, the responsible agent for all these things happening, and all of a sudden you start coming up with rational scientific explanations for them. And all of a sudden God steps a couple of steps back and isn't the cause for that particular thing. And in that process of explaining things through science and then God as a reason for things happening, stepping back, you get this movement that Taylor calls the disenchantment of the universe. It's not enchanted because we can explain so many things factually. So gravity just being one example of it. Well, that unfolded over hundreds of years, but Charles Taylor wants to make the point that it had this overall effect of making us understand the world differently. When our car breaks down, we don't think that an evil spirit has inhabited our engine.
I do.
And we don't take it to someone who will put burning sage over the top of it. There are reasons why you might go to someone who would burn sage. And we all maybe have experiences with that in certain kinds of religious rituals. But for your car, when the engine is broken, you go down to the mobile station and the friendly mechanics fix it and then give you a bill. Another hook that helps us think about this transition is the way in which time changes. This great picture, American Gothic, represents many things. One of the things it represents is a kind of diligence, a kind of commitment to, some of the things Ben Franklin argued for. What are some Franklinisms that come to mind?
Penny
saved is a penny earned.
Early to bed, early to rise.
Makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. What else?
The early bird gets the worm.
Early bird gets
the
worm.
Stitch in time, saves nine.
Poor Richard's Almanac distributed this wisdom far and wide. What did it do? Well, if you think back to what life was like in medieval Catholic Europe, there was understanding of the universe, in a sense, being heaven, earth, and hell, three-story cosmos, and stable. And then the sun, you know, everything else rotated around that. And the liturgical year was really the most powerful ordering of time. And so there would be, like, we're going on a family heritage trip to Norway and Sweden later this summer, and I'm not Norwegian or Swedish or Danish or Finnish at all, so I've had to do actually book reading to learn about these strange people that I'm now joined to by marriage. And so I was reading about Christmas traditions, because we often spent Christmas with Sonia's family. And I come from mostly German background, and so we were much more, I think, prone to beer drinking than Sonia's family, who has more of a tradition with the Christian Women's Temperance Union and Norwegian Pietism and so forth. Well, I was really happy to discover that they used to measure the length of Christmas by how long the Christmas beer lasted. But the idea was there was this celebration of Christmas that was really time out of time. And so the liturgical year structured a way of alternating between ordinary time, the dailiness of work and family life, and then these festival times, these higher times, if you will, that didn't necessarily have a set period as long as the beer lasted. And there were a lot of them throughout the year. And if you want to have an efficient capitalist economy that has workers showing up on a regular basis on time and prepared to work, that kind of society doesn't work very well. That understanding of time doesn't work very well. And so as, now this is a little shift, but it's related. The scientific worldview grows up in Western Europe alongside the capitalist economy, and as that emerges, society needs something different from its people. It needs regularity. It needs Ben Franklin.
Time is money.
Yeah, exactly. So all of a sudden, you get this shift in understanding time. It's not that these higher times, these festival times are good. They're wasted time. And that is a really profound shift. I mean, I took my watch off, and I'm looking at the clock over here, and you came at 4 for the session. And we don't even really think about that most of the time. But our whole assumption about time is related to that. And one of the fascinating things about human culture is that they hold on to older ways of understanding. So they're still present in many respects. And different cultures and subcultures hold on and experience these differently. So my colleague Tony Machado, who's Puerto Rican, talks about marrying this Scandinavian from Wisconsin, and their families getting together, and her family expecting his family to come to dinner early, and they get there an hour late, and they think that's just like, that's when you get there, and but they were really upset that they were an hour late. So this culture clash in how they understood time, and so you can still see this variability in how we deal with time, but the example in terms of economic change is a really powerful example in how we make certain kinds of assumptions. Well, these are connected, these big shifts in science and in the economy are connected to shifts in religious beliefs. And Charles Taylor talks about what he calls the modern moral order, the kind of the kind of organization of society and the kind of beliefs that would lead to the kind of people that we would need for these upstanding, well-oiled, democratic, capitalist societies to succeed. And so there's a set of interconnected beliefs that emerge from this couple hundred year transition. One of them is the eclipse of transcendence. Why does that happen? Well, partly it's the disenchantment explanation through the scientific method begins to shift how transcendence is understood. And the emphasis on reason becomes a really important religious idea that God has implanted reason in us and structured the world reasonably with natural laws that can be discovered. And so, in a sense, God gets cut off. God, in this model, is envisioned as a watchmaker. Anybody heard that analogy before? Yeah, so God creates the world in all its intricacy and sets it off running and then steps back. And it follows its own internal laws, which can be discovered. And so transcendence then is not necessarily eclipsed, but it changes. It becomes, so like Adam Smith, the famous economist who wrote The Wealth of Nations, knew that there had to be a way for us to live together well and to care about each other, so he wrote this other book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And he basically said God implants in us this sentiment of compassion, and if I look at that in myself, then it can give me this motivation to be concerned about my neighbor. And he spells out this, really, it's a secularized version of love your neighbor as yourself, drawing on what God has implanted in me. So I don't anymore need heaven. Heaven is here. Heaven is in natural laws, and heaven is in this moral sense in me. A second is the eclipse of grace. Well, grace is actually unacceptable. What happens with grace if you do something wrong?
There's an excuse, or there's a reason.
You're forgiven.
We can't have that. We have to have accountability. Grace is like festival times. Very inconvenient.
And you're surprised.
You're surprised. Yeah. That's right.
Reason is predictable and controlled.
Exactly. So reason is sufficient. Reason is God's, in a sense, God's gift is not grace. God's gift is reason. And that gift allows us to be able to understand what it is that God has set out for us in terms of our lives. A third piece of this shift in religious understanding is the eclipse of mystery, providence as evidence. This just connects with the things we've already said. And the last one is the eclipse of salvation. This is a little trickier, but it connects to the grace idea that a person becomes healthy, wealthy, and wise by their actions, by getting up early, by working hard. And so you get a shift from salvation coming by grace. You know, the person who comes at the 11th hour gets the same. No, the person who comes at the 11th hour loses out. In a sense, explain salvation in terms of a kind of human flourishing, the good life. And the good life is achieved by hard work, by self-sacrifice, by discipline. And in a sense, salvation is let go of, but judgment is held on to. So if you think about some of the deists, including some of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, for example, many of them let go of some of these classical, what you might think of as orthodox Christian ideas, but held on to the idea of God as a judge at the end of time. Why? Because it fed right into moral motivation. And it was, I think, actually quite disingenuous, because often this was held on to by some of the intellectual elites for the sake, they thought, of keeping the rabble in line. If the ordinary people believe that God is the judge of history and at the end will be accounted for the good and bad that we did, the responsible and irresponsible that we did, they thought it would help, in a sense, create a more orderly society. So all of these, I just included the happy humanist symbol, which is much more recent, but in a sense makes me giggle, because you look at the happy humanist and I just think Pentecostal. Praise the Lord. But you have this new moral order emerging, and it happens over centuries, and it starts with the intellectuals. It doesn't start with ordinary people, but the shift is slow and persistent, and it begins to, in a sense, diffuse out into society as time goes by, and as the structure of society literally changes. And so people begin, without really even noticing it, to conceive of themselves and of their life differently. So I want to shift and talk about ways, the shift in how people understand themselves happened, reaching back to 500 years ago and more. A conception of the self might have been understood as much more given. I have three words: the porous, communal, and durable, to understand it. But you could say the porousness was a sense that we were much more vulnerable because of belief in spirits, because of God's intervention, God's presence and activity. And so, for example, think about sneezing. What do you say when someone sneezes? Why?
The demons from coming in.
The demons, the plague. There's a set of, in a sense, enchanted reasons why that originated. Why do we continue to say it? Is the plague a worry? Is do we fear demons invading us in that moment when we sneeze? Most of us don't, but we continue to say it. And it harkens back to a time when we had a conception of the self that was quite different, a much different sense of vulnerability. Communal and durable sort of interconnect, and there was this sense that there were that medieval Europe was held together by the nobility and the knights, the sort of protection, and the peasants. And that structure of society was fairly durable, and where one was born sort of gave you who you would be. Martin Luther, if you read his writings about vocation, is actually pretty conservative in that regard. It rubs people the wrong way today, because he'll say, stay in your station. He encourages people to be happy where they are. And we can sentimentalize that and say, bloom where you're planted. But if your life is terrible and you're scraping out potatoes from a barren field, it doesn't feel very good for someone to say, bloom where you're planted. So there was a kind of durability, and the communal sense really was true of many, many more ancient societies, that the individual wasn't the first, but the we, the communal, was the first. And in the context of the communal, I made sense. And so you think about the wall around the city, and they had harvest festivals, and everyone in the community had to come, and the priest would lead it, and they would march around the walls of the city, and they would sprinkle water, and they would have this whole day-long festival. And what if you decided you didn't want to go? I don't feel like going today. It puts the whole community at risk, because you had a headache. No, everybody went. It depended on everybody going, because it was the community's sacrifice, in a sense, that allowed for them to trust God's blessing for harvest and protection and so on. We would feel very put upon. And Holden, in a sense, is totally countercultural, because we say as a community our discipline is to all go to Vespers every night, whether we feel like it or not. How many places do that? So this is an alternative farming picture from contemporary North Dakota. And there's one farmer in this and one farmer in that, and they're driving these big combine and I don't know what that's called, just a wheelbarrow, I guess, gathering it behind that tractor. But the words here are buffered, individual, and fragile. And the buffered is just the sense of a relative distinctness. When I say God bless you, I'm being polite. I'm not actually worried about you being invaded by evil spirits during the sort of millisecond when your sneeze is coming out of you. And we constitute ourselves primarily as individuals and communal beings second. And it really is the very structure of the way our society is set up. We have a society that's set up so the law protects what? And what does it protect for the individual?
Their rights.
Their individual rights. Their rights of property. Their rights, as we say in our founding documents, the right to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. So the very constitution of our society imagines us all to be, first of all, individuals who then contract together for this we the people. And fragile, why fragile? Well, I'm going to say a little bit more about that in just a second, but the basic idea is that as we become individuals who no longer necessarily are given a life, then we have to figure out what our life is. Options create fragility and other things besides. There's a kind of fragileness to the desperateness that I see with young parents, you know, making their kids listen to Mozart for Babies, you know, hoping that that's going to give them the edge when they get to college applications. They don't want to leave it to chance because it's not a sure thing who they're going to be. It's not a sure thing what will be available for them as options. This is just a sort of, anybody see this movie, The Pursuit of Happiness? It was just a very sort of popular version of this whole mythology that we have about who we are as people who pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And part of the reason why a movie like this works, I want to argue, is because the background assumptions that we share are so powerful. I mean, it was a very well done movie, and moving, and in some respects, played with cultural and racial ethnic stereotypes that we have, but nonetheless, the main trajectory of the movie is working hard and trying to get a break so that you can make it for the sake of yourself and your family. Well, this set of shifts that leads us to the kind of selves we are has, as a part of its set of assumptions, some really powerful orienting values, which we act out of all the time, and I just want to point to a couple and see what you think of them. This is a fellow in Minneapolis at the Cub Foods trying to pick a Campbell soup. And, well, you know, I counted them. I think there's over 220 options there in the soup aisle that he's faced with. And so it makes a little bit of fun of this, but choosing, having the possibility of choosing is deep in us. And it's not just in a simplistic way. What are some other ways in which you think choice really shows up in our culture as a major
spouse?
Yeah. Don't tell me who to marry. And it's really fascinating to watch new immigrant communities, Indian or other new immigrant communities who had habits of arranged marriages and working out the breaking down and renegotiation of that, or just the fiddler on the roof. I mean, that's right in the heart of that story. What else?
Career and vocational options.
Yeah, what kind of job and choosing a major that leads to that. You know, I had one major in mind when I went to college, and I didn't get good enough grades in that major.
Well, and gender roles.
Gender roles.
The color of your refrigerator.
Choosing a congregation. Choosing
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Don't make me go to the old parish model, even among Catholics, is totally broken. people drive by two or three Catholic parishes to get to one where they like the priest.
Which amounts to choosing what you think is holy,
yeah,
or what works for you, or...
But what happens if you go to the store and your favorite toothpaste isn't there? Do you just buy another one?
No, you go somewhere else.
Yeah. I go somewhere else, or I wait, because I like my kind of toothpaste. I don't want to use... Sonia and I have this long and pretty funny dialogue about what kind of toothpaste could we, you know, we love each other, we share so much in common, couldn't we just share toothpaste? But she likes her kind and I like my kind. So, but think about the abortion debate. At the heart of the cultural politics of our country for decades, and at the heart of it is a debate about choice. And the right, the individual right to choose. What does that consist of? And those debates are all the way from the ridiculous, this poor fellow trying to choose a can of soup among the 200 varieties, to these really profound issues of our very bodies, of our hopes for family, our possibility for certain kinds of health care. So that, I'm just trying to set before us the way in which this really powerful value comes out of this whole trajectory that we've been trying to articulate, and is one of those background issues which deeply shapes little things we do every day. And we don't necessarily think about how remarkable it is, how contemporary it is, how it wasn't at all a deeply orienting reality in other times and places. Yeah.
Isn't there a lot of evidence that the greater the number of choices, the less the happiness with the choice you make? And I kind of think about, like, the food here. You know, you kind of, it's take it or leave it is your choice, and yet everyone in that room seems pretty happy. You know? And, yeah, you know, you wonder if that, we bought into that culture of choice, but if we bought into a culture of unhappiness.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a, you could say that there's a possibility of it going farther than we actually can sustain. You can't take in that many options. But I think if that's on the one hand, on the other hand is the possibility that we actually don't want zero choices. Like the whole, when you go and or at least before the wall fell, you go and you visit some of the Eastern Bloc countries, and one of the stark differences people realized was, oh, you don't have any choices. You go to the store and there's one of this. So somewhere in between there...
Well, there's this bondage that emerges when the grass looks greener.
Yeah.
Certainly that job would be better.
Yeah.
Or, I'm okay in this church until something I disagree with, then certainly it would be better someplace else.
Yeah.
And so there's this kind of restlessness that unless
it's built
my
in.
Desires,
it's
I'm not
built
happy.
In. And it's built in partly because of the way we do pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. Express yourself, be authentic.
Yeah.
We have this sense that we have to make ourselves in a way. And we make ourselves by a particular kind of journey of choosing. I'm choosing this versus that. I'm choosing this spouse versus that spouse. I'm choosing this career versus that career, this church versus that church. And why am I choosing it? Because it resonates, you know? It gives me a sense of fit, and it allows me to express my values. I would have a really hard time being happy in a church where all the time it felt like what was being celebrated was something other than what I deeply believe. So there's this... central sense that it's a resonance. What makes for a good life, what makes in a sense for happiness, is this intersection between my sense of who I am and what I choose to do, to be involved in, how I choose to live. And that plays directly into spiritual life. So here's the thumbs up action figure Jesus, who's encouraging us. What? He's encouraging us to, you know, go do it. It's a kind of odd thing that I think reflects some of the elements of our culture now. in the U.S., the dominant culture in the U.S., that we have this action figure Jesus who's cheering us on, you know. Who's the pastor, Joel Olstein, in Houston, who has this old basketball, NBA basketball arena as a home for the church, and their motto is bringing out the champion in you. And it has all at the heart of it is this sort of journey of choice and authentic living, becoming who you can be. And the one of the problems that this creates is it's fragility, right? I'm not sure who I am, and I'm not sure who I can become. We used to sing this little song to our kids, "You can be anybody that you want to be." And I stopped singing it. I like it, actually, and I learned it from the Atlanta Gay Male Chorus, and it has a really powerful resonance in oppressed communities. I can be more than you determine that I can be. But in our really privileged situation, that wasn't the issue. And I realized what I was singing to them was this ideology that you can be anything that you want to be, and they can't. Or at least it's not the most important value to me. So I started singing another song from one of Paul's letters, "God, who began a good work in you, will bring it to completion in Christ Jesus." So I don't really know what that is, but you see how the flip happens, and I think part of the anxiety of our culture and that anxiety drives a lot of the choices people make trying to find happiness is this sense of not being sure who I am, but feeling like I have to figure it out. And figuring it out means that I've succeeded. I found the good life. Yeah.
And if it's predicated on success, and like in the NFL, success means that 31 teams have failed and only one is successful.
Yeah.
It means you're competing with everybody.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how do you create community if you have to win?
Yeah. I mean, that's why I was so blessed to have Dan Erlander as a campus pastor, because he always told us the story of the pointless people. If you don't know it, it's coming out as a book, and you can read it. Well, I think it leads the intersection of these values as they impact the spiritual life lead to some tensions, and I want to talk through those tensions so we set them on the table. One is what you just were raising, the relationship between individual and community, and how they connect. Anybody who's looked for a church knows this challenge. Do I privilege allegiance to and participation in a community over against my own happiness? What if the pastor leaves and they call a new pastor and I can't stand her or him? Do I have allegiance to this community in which I belong, or do I look for a place that's more fulfilling to me? That tension plays out in lots of different ways. Another really central tension is between belief and practice. The challenge with set of beliefs, which we know aren't, what's the word for it? There's a great variation in adherence to traditional beliefs. That's partly what unfolded from that shift over the couple of centuries with the introduction of science and of other changes in the structure of Christianity. And so various kinds of trajectories of believing opened up that didn't necessarily follow just Orthodox Christianity. And the practices, in a sense, become disconnected from beliefs. And so people might pick up various practices that they like, which don't necessarily need to come with the beliefs. So someone may love, the Lutheran, in fact, had on its cover a couple of months ago a picture of a, quote, atheist who loves this congregation in Iowa or wherever it is because he loves to sing. So here he's coming to church every Sunday, participating in the practice of communal hymn singing while not believing really anything he's singing. So that kind of tension we see more commonly. Yoga is another interesting example. Lots of people practice yoga, love yoga, but it's not that important to them, really, its rootedness in Hindu religious ideas. And so you can disconnect belief and practice, and that leads to all kinds of interesting tensions. And what some, like Robert Withnow, who's a great commentator on religion in the United States, says is tinkering, religious tinkering. People sort of bring together different pieces. I like this belief, I like this practice, and that sort of works for me. Anybody ever heard of that? Tinkering? Any tinkerers in there?
Well, and Belloc called that, you know, that was
Sheilaism. Sheilaism is a very particular thing, which is sort of claiming that the most important religious authority is in me, yeah. My own sense of what's right. Sheila said, I guess I listen to myself. I listen to my own sense of things. I call it Sheilaism. You know, it was really sort of sweet if you read it, Inhabitants of the Heart.
But
it's
sort of like sweet. Tinkering, though, in the sense that tinkers, it's what, you know, it's their choosing out of their own individual self.
Yeah.
That they construct their own religious.
That system. Becomes the, in a sense, the center pole around which then you make these decisions about I like this, I like that. Exactly. It's directly related. So commitment and pluralism is another one. When I know that there are these other possible trajectories, what happens to my sense of commitment? My sense of commitment to a particular way of believing and living. One of the things that happens is my commitment becomes more fragile. It becomes more fragile in this sense. I don't believe in such a way that I know no other way. We don't have the option of believing that way. Why is it that there's this big trend of people joining, say, Orthodox Judaism or Orthodox Christianity? I just did an interview with new priests at St. Vladimir's, which is a historically Russian Orthodox seminary in New York. And the dean there said, 10 years ago, 75% of their students grew up Orthodox. Now, 75% of their students are new converts to Orthodoxy. I think that's partly happening because in a context of pluralism and not knowing where my roots are, people are choosing, in a sense, to block all this out and go for this place where they know there are deep roots. Because they want that, even though they know that they don't get it just by virtue of their family and their tradition. So there's a tension people are negotiating there. This is the last one, I think. Transcendence and immanence. So, you know, God isn't up there. We have all this language in our liturgy and hymnody about God being up there, but I've been up there. You know, how many of you flew here? And God wasn't there. You know, above the clouds is space and the moon and stuff. And so we don't have the same conception of transcendence. Most of us who've been through these fires of understanding the world scientifically. And so then what happens to transcendence? Well, you go into a Gothic cathedral, and there's a sense of transcendence. You go out in Railroad Creek Valley, and there's a sense of transcendence. But the sense of what transcendence means has become challenged. And sometimes it's a very present sense of transcendence. So immanence and transcendence have shifted in terms of their meanings, and we work out what we mean by those terms. So Charles Taylor talks about a supernova being a metaphor or analogy for what's happened to the spiritual life with all of these tensions that have emerged because of the changes in our society. And so the options, he says, have just exploded exponentially. The ways in which we put together what it is to be spiritual people, to be people of faith. And when that happens, it just, in a sense, feeds itself. Because you know that there are these various options, and you put together a life, and then your children or your friends or your congregation, in a sense, see that. And he really argues that it broke open in a powerful way in everyday life through the 50s and 60s across Western Europe and the U.S., that the sort of, bless you, the experimental I had to do it right. The experimentalism that happened broadly broke open to a much wider swath of society the proximity to options. And the reopening of immigration, at least in North America in the 60s, also contributed to greater proximity to people who are living these different trajectories. And so one of the arguments that I want you to ponder is, and this is the last piece, that it shifts the way many people experience congregations. So if you think about Martin Luther, he was born on November 10th, 1583, and he was named Martin because the next day, the 11th, was the feast of St. Martin of Tours. And he was brought to church the next day on the feast of St. Martin, and so he was named Martin, his baptismal saint. And then he grew up in that experience of local participation in congregational life. So he was born, in a sense, into this religion and entered immediately into congregational life, which taught him the practices of faith. Some people still experience that. I mean, I've learned that the Midwest still has some Christendom. But for many people, especially in urban centers, especially in the Northeast and the West Coast of the U.S., it's increasingly that people aren't born into a religion, or they may be, but it's really low key, and they end up wandering away from it, and they find practices they like. And the practices, these links are much weaker now. The practices may be connected to a community or a congregation which can help interpret the deeper meaning and sense of this practice. And so the person, through choosing this practice, may meet a community which can help them to understand this practice more deeply. And through that, may actually be led to a whole religious tradition which gives depth and history and a kind of interconnectedness to other practices which hold together a way of life. But each one of those links now is much weaker than they were 500 years ago for all the reasons that we've talked about. And I think imagining that offers local congregations food for thought in what they do and how they imagine the people who interconnect with them in terms of the various activities that they sponsor, whether it's a Friday night taizé service that you might do, whether it's having, you know, a soup kitchen that people come and help with, whatever it is. It reframes, I think, the opportunity that we have to explicitly work at making these connections from a practice to a community of practice that helps make sense of the meaning of that practice and invite people, say, how deep do you want to go? How much do you want to know about what it is that you're excited about? Sarah Miles wrote a great book called Take This Bread, is that the title?
Yeah.
And that's the story. That's exactly the story. And it's a great example of what spiritual questing is like today and what congregations, when they're prepared. And St. Gregory of Nyssa was prepared in many respects. She points out ways they weren't. But when they're prepared, then they can be a place of reception and of grounding for people who really are at sea, who don't exactly know what it is that they feel in them. St. Augustine said, my heart is restless until it rests in you, O Lord. And I think we may know that, but there are many people who know the restlessness, but they don't know where it will find rest. And so this is, a way of conceptualizing what's going on today and how congregations can, in a sense, be prepared for receiving the kinds of wanderers who are coming in. We're even after 5, so I apologize for going on a little long. I'm happy to talk more about this informally as we wander through the next day or so, but I hope this has provoked you, and I encourage you to, if you're interested in the ideas, to check out either what Charles Taylor writes himself or things written about him, because he's a really helpful thinker trying to help make sense about religion today. So thanks for coming. It's called A Secular Age. Okay.